On today's show, we have John Suggs, founder and president of Family Orchard, LLC. John has over a dozen years' experience as a genetic genealogist, specializing in analyzing DNA, as well as the more traditional investigatory practices to assist adult adoptees' search for and reunite with their birth parents and birth siblings. In addition, John also works with adults of unknown parentage, looking to include people whose mothers conceived using anonymous sperm donors. A former Jesuit, John was trained in community organizing by the Jesuits and Miles Horton of the Highlander Folk School. Horton is the man who trained numerous civil rights leaders as community organizers, including the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and Rosa Parks, amongst many others. John worked as a homeless advocate before becoming a founder and the first executive director of the Los Angeles Coalition to End Hunger and Homelessness, where he co-convened the very first conference in the nation on educating homeless children. As a lead investigator for the Los Angeles City Ethics Commission, John successfully conducted a series of investigations into bribes to elected officials and campaign money laundering, which at that time included the largest governmental ethics financial settlement in U.S. history. He holds a BA in political science from Loyola Marymount University, an MS in management and systems from New York University, and an MBA from Fordham University. His NYU master's thesis was entitled Genetic Testing and Privacy: The Role of Anonymous Genetic Testing and Information Technology. My Favorite Detective Stories podcast features past or present detectives and investigative journalists. As a working investigator of over 42 years, I hope to inform, inspire, and entertain you with great stories. We want to learn from our guests how they got started in the field and why they decided to become investigators in the first place. Listen as they tell us about the early years and who were their mentors and why those mentors had such a huge impact on their careers. We'll explore what makes for a good investigator and what makes for good investigation. But most importantly, after you get to know our guests, we will ask them for their favorite detective story, or maybe two. Stay tuned. The interview is about to begin. Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I'm telling you, I love that reading that bio, and there's so much we can go through today, and I really look forward to talking to you about all the things that you've done. But my first question always is, when people ask you what you do, what do you tell them?
Well, that's a good question. The shorthand is I'm a genetic genealogist. And precisely because of that career, that profession didn't even exist 15 years ago. I usually get a glazed look and it goes over people's heads and I know that they don't have a clue what I'm talking about. So then I'll explain that basically I analyze DNA. And through the analysis and through my background of investigatory practices, I'm able to help adult adoptees find their birth parents and their birth siblings, and also people who have unknown parentage. It's usually the paternal side, obviously, and also for test tube babies. That most people aren't thinking about it, but we now have situations that the people have grown up and are adults now that whose moms went to sperm banks for sperm donations, or they got egg donations as well. And so these adults are now interested to see and to discover who their biological connections are.
That's amazing stuff. And it's all cutting edge. It's all brand new.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I know that the glazed look myself as well. There was one time when I was a missing heir researcher, and people said, missing heir? Well, where's the missing heir? It's all around us. And I said, no, heirs, like herbs, heirs. So,
yeah.
Yes. So I understand the glazed look. This is really exciting stuff. And how did you get started in it? Can you just tell me that?
Well, sure. It's pretty much a straight trajectory of my entire adult life. After I had graduated from college, I joined the Jesuits. And the Jesuits trained me in community organizing and in doing power analysis. Because to be a good community organizer, you go into a situation and you want to change it, theoretically. And so the standard rule is that the status quo is the status quo because somebody's benefiting from it. And so your first task is to figure out who's benefiting from the status quo, to do an analysis of who has the power that can actually make the decisions to change a situation and hopefully to better the situation. And so with that, it required me to research a lot of deeds and property forms to do all sorts of things to be able to figure out just who is the person behind the veil and who, how do you get to that person and put pressure on them.
I see.
And so that's my work as a community organizer.
Okay.
But then after that, I was in the judges for 5 years. I don't know if your listeners know, but it's an order within the Catholic Church, and it is the longest training within the Catholic Church. It takes 15 to 16 years of training before you can become an ordained Jesuit priest. And I made it through a third of the way, 5 years, and I left in, you know, good terms. And in fact, we have a former Jesuit reunion every year, and it's so fun to go to. It's one of the, it's a great weekend I look forward to. But after that, I used my skills that I had acquired and became a homeless organizer. And from there, I had probably my first professional recognized investigative position. I was hired by the brand new Ethics Commission for the City of Los Angeles to hunt out and to investigate corruption and to hunt out and investigate money laundering. And so we were brand new. In fact, we didn't even, they didn't even give us a key to the washroom in town hall. that we actually, because we were not that welcomed, and we were seen as outside interlopers, and you know, and who are these guys? Because we were created by an initiative that was on the ballot, a ballot initiative. So this wasn't anything that any political reformers were arguing for. This was hoisted upon them, and so. But one of the key things was that when I was doing an investigation for the Ethics Commission, I had to be very, very careful, because if anything leaked out about it, and if somebody's name was in the LA Times and it was saying, you know, so-and-so investigated by the Ethics Commission, we could literally destroy careers, rightly and wrongly. And so a tactic that I always used is when I was looking into a specific vote or a specific, corporation or an entity that had business before the town, I would go to the town clerk's office and pull those files. But simultaneously, I would pull about 25 other files that had absolutely nothing to do and had no interest for me at all. But it was the only way that I could camouflage and make certain that no one in the town clerk's office and therefore in City Hall would know exactly what it was that I was looking for. And the campaign money laundering issue, it was, in those days, it was like shooting fish in a barrel. There had been no oversight. And so everybody in the political campaigns and in the political spectrum had gotten really kind of lackadaisical and kind of lazy. And so I started with just looking at the filings, because every candidate has to file who gave them money and how much and what their occupation is. And so to start with, it was just pulling those campaign reports and going down and discovering something very unique, which was over and over again, I would find babysitters contributing the maximum amount, or housekeepers contributing the maximum amount, or students the same, and even for candidates that weren't even in the district in which they lived in. And so those would be the first tips of that there was something wrong here. And they, like I said, before the Ethics Commission and before I started these investigations came along, I mean, they were so brazen about it, they would just put it down and that nobody would do anything about it. So what the issue at hand is that when you're laundering money, that in the laws, that they have a cap of how much an individual can contribute to a particular election, whether it's a local election or on up. And so, and say a corporation wants to get a new, something passed by the town council that will benefit their company. What has happened in the past has been that they will come up with a true source of the funds and say 100,000, 200,000 or more, a true source of funds. but they want to disguise that they are the people that are introducing and putting the money into play because of the influence they want to purchase with that. And so they'll hire people, middle people, to serve as bundlers. And this still goes on at the national levels and so forth, but the bundlers then is required to collect as many checks as they can for the maximum amount of the donation. And so then they come back with the 100,000 turns or whatever the amount is that was the true source in smaller increments by, you know, 40, 50, 60 people with 40, 50, 60 individual checks. And those were written by the babysitters and the housekeepers and the students. So we have subpoena power, and long story short, we subpoena their bank records and be able to see that, you know, the check was cut this day, and on the same day, a deposit in the same amount was deposited into their account. And so then we build on that, we figure out who was the one that asked them to do it, and, you know, work your way up the chain until you get to the original true source of the money.
That's great. That's a good story. Did you ever come across any dogs or cats that were the givers of any money? Oh, they wouldn't have a checking account.
Yeah, that was the thing. You have to have a checking account.
just not a name, but yeah, a valid checking account. So, and in doing that type of work, I can see where your foundation from your Jesuit training would make absolutely perfect sense, and that you would be able to use those skills and apply that to your investigative techniques going forward. Now, your more recent work, that is that of a genetic genealogist, how is it that you got into that type of work?
Well, when I went back to school, I was in grad school at NYU, and I did my master's thesis on anonymous genetic testing. And this was early, early in the days that it was still more predictive than anything else. The DNA testing abilities hadn't been commercialized and expanded. So at that time, I patterned my vision and my recommendation from the 1980s AIDS tests, that for any of those that were around at the time, you may remember that one of the things that helped curtail the epidemic of AIDS in our country was when people could go and be tested to see if they were HIV positive anonymously. And because the stigma attached and the discrimination that would be attached if the word got out that they were HIV positive. And so when I originally was doing my master's work, we were actually thinking of employment discrimination based on your DNA.
How about that?
You know, that you are predisposed to a certain illness and so forth. And the adoption didn't even piece in together at that point. But I quickly became an expert in this field, and at its infancy. And what we've seen is a dramatic explosion. That you need to understand that there are just a handful of DNA tests that are applicable for this type of work. Your listeners know anything that the adoption community has been discriminated against for decades, and have been treated as second-class citizens, and have been denied access to the information they would need to be able to figure out who their birth mother is, or birth father.
And to that point, I mentioned earlier to you about my foray into missing heir research previously.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had a pretty good website, and I was attracting a lot of people coming to me from the adoption world, thinking that my genealogy skills would apply to their adoption needs. And the smartest thing I did was contacted a man by the name of John Suggs.
Uh-huh.
And I said, John, here's all the information I have, and this is why, and I hope that you two can connect on this and make it happen. And that's the truth. We're not kidding.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I understood my limitations as a private investigator and as a missing heir researcher, but there were other limitations too by the agency personnel as well. And if you could just tell me a little bit about how those limitations of both a private investigator and an agency are, why they're limited, and why is it that you're able to do what you're able to do and get the kind of results that you get?
Sure. Well, I remember that case that you shared with specifically, and I remember you concerned about whether or not that you had authorization or there might be legal liability for you to make the connection for the child and the parent, or the adult child and the parent. And that you wanted to do was to reach out to the person first to make sure that they would welcome the connection, part for your own liability, but also out of respect and what the custom is. And that is what agency investigators do all the time, because there are different ways of finding your niche in this field. I'm a genetic genealogist who work directly for the adult adoptee. They are my client. Okay. You can also work for agencies that now, and state agencies and private and nonprofit agencies who have are tasked with and responsible with providing what is called non-identifying information. And so the laws in most of the states, and we're working hard to change them, state that when an adult adoptee goes to the adoption agency that worked with them, or that managed or handled their adoption, that they are not legally allowed to give the names of the birth parents, and they can't give any kind of information that would lead the adult adoptee to be able to identify them.
I'm raising my hands in frustration saying, what? So what's the fallacy there?
Well, the fallacy is twofold, is that it re-traumatizes the adult adoptee because he's meeting another door. Because what I always tell them is your parents, your adopted parents have lied to you or have omitted information to you in the past. The agencies have lied to you or omitted information. The courts have and your government have. Most people don't know this, but adoptees have not one but two birth certificates. That there is an original birth certificate that's issued when the mother gives birth to the child. And that is called the OBC, the original birth certificate. But when an infant is adopted, the courts issue a second birth certificate and change out the names of the parents and put the adopted parent's name in. And then that is the birth certificate that is issued to the adult adoptee. They're not granted access to their original birth certificate with the real names of who gave them birth.
So how did it come to be that this change of dealing, because it wasn't always that way, right?
Absolutely. And many years ago, it was all open and transparent, and it was just fine. It wasn't an issue. But as I'm sure your listeners will appreciate, that again, the status quo is the status quo because someone is benefiting from it. So who's benefiting from the status quo that it is sealed records? And where this came about was to cover up a crime. The original person that came up with the idea that adoption records should be sealed was an infamous woman named Georgia Tan. Georgia Tan ran an adoption agency in Mississippi, and it was a racket. This was in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and she died right at the turn of the decade of the 1950s. And the investigation of her, she died literally the week the investigation came out, testifying to all of her misdeeds. But Georgia Tan had a system in place where, in Mississippi, that she would not just wait for a single mom or maternity home to relinquish a child for adoption. She would make it happen. Georgia Tan stole children, stole infants. And it got more and more brazen as the years went along that typically her ideal snatch was an infant, a small child that was blonde-haired, blue-eyed, and white. Because her clients, the adopted parents, were mostly based in New York and in California, and they were high net worth individuals. In fact, there were some very famous individuals that utilized her services, including Joan Crawford. Your readers, your listeners may be familiar with a famous movie called Mommy Dearest, where one of the two adoptees that Joan Crawford raised, they both came from Georgia Tan's system. She writes, she wrote a book and it became a hit movie. Basically, she's, you know, taking on her mom and letting everybody know how screwed up her mom was and how damaging she was, and so forth. That child, now an adult, she was part of this child trafficking, human trafficking. And so it became very, very, I mean, there were literally thousands and thousands of children that over the decades that went through Georgia Tan's system. And many of them died because they didn't give proper care. And there's just, I mean, she was a true sociopath. And yet she had a lot of political clout, both in her home state and in elsewhere. And so, for example, New York to this day has the toughest open record laws against adult adoptees, to seal the records, not make them open, in the country. And the governor of New York that signed those laws into place originally was one of Georgia Tan's clients. He adopted one of these stolen children and then signed the legislation into law, making it impossible to be able to trace and to find who the connections were, because the sealed records initially were designed to cover up crimes.
Wow, that's amazing stuff. And what is happening now to change those laws, and what's happening now with the advent of these DNA testing abilities to reduce the barriers to bringing adoptees to their natural birth parents or their siblings?
Well, it's happening on a state-by-state basis because of the way in which the laws are that govern adoptions in this country. Here in Connecticut, we have been trying for years to get legislation passed, and we have another bill that is coming up for a hearing in the next month to open the original birth records up. But what has happened is that the law has been trumped by the DNA. Remember I talked about autosomal DNA testing, which only came on the market 9 years ago. What that has enabled people to do is to get their DNA tested and then find matches of second cousins, third cousins, and so forth, and to be able to find their parents on their own, to literally run circles around the laws. And that is happening literally on a daily basis. We are literally in a position now where foundlings are little infants, newborn children, newborn babies that are left on the proverbial church doorstep with no note, no information, nothing. That there are plenty of foundlings out there, and those that have grown to adulthood, we're now finding their families through the DNA when we would have had nothing, because there was not a clue, not a scrap of evidence, nothing that our investigation could uncover to be able to answer the clue who their parents were other than the DNA.
So by going back the number of generations, you make a connection to somebody else that's in the database.
Yes.
And then it's moving forward. And then not only moving forward, but narrowing the search to the birth parents, or at least the immediate family.
Exactly. There's several techniques that we use. Two that I can just quickly describe is called mirroring family trees, a mirror of the family tree, and the other is the regressive analysis of the family tree. So And I always urge people that all the agencies, because there's about 5 or 6 DNA testing sites out there, they're all good. And for adoptees, I tell them if they can afford it, get tested in all of them, because you're fishing in all the different ponds. But if you can only afford one, at this point, there's one that is the clear leader. And by far, I have no financial connection to them or anything, but I will happily tell you that would be Ancestry DNA. They have over 7 million people now in their database. And you're going to need to realize that for each of those 7 million, they have 7 generations of their family in the database as well. So it just, the extrapolation is mind-boggling how far this goes. And so with that, when I see, I get the raw DNA data, I analyze that, and then I can find for matches. And so there may be like, say, five or six third cousins, you know, when one's removed, what have you. And I will build out their trees, or if I'm lucky, they already have a tree, because so many people on Ancestry and the other genealogy sites, you know, are doing it because they want to connect with relatives. And so they openly share their trees to see how they connect. That I will make a significant collection to mirror their matches trees, and then tie my client as the true source with their DNA and let it populate out over that tree. And then what happens is it just lights up like Christmas lights, you know, where the connection is out of all those possible sources of all the great-great-grandparents that you have.
So you're able to make a match between the family trees, which are separate relational databases, mm-hmm. and they show you hits.
Absolutely. And so then with that information, then I go to the next step, which is the regression analysis, and start building out dozens and dozens of trees. And this is very time consuming. But if you have a love for research, if you have a love for history, because you need to understand each, you know, decade, what was going on in that part of the world and so forth, you're natural for this, is that then I'm able to have done my own quick and dirty family trees for matches. And I emphasize quick and dirty because I'm not footnoting them and documenting them, and, you know, it's not being prepared for a daughter of the American Revolution submission application. It's just for me to use. And then when I've got enough of those, I overlay them one on top of the other, and I do this all on the computer, and then I'm quickly able to discern where the clear direction is going for this family and for my client. And then from there, it's typical, standard, normal investigative work of, you know, doing, you know, the background checks, doing, you know, address searches and so forth, and just finding the people. And what's interesting is that now with social media, like Facebook, that adoptees, both the ones that I work with and the ones that I'm not working with, they tend to flock to Facebook and primarily Facebook, but other social media sites, and start to find their you know, their cousin's nephew that has a posting on Facebook, and then you look at the friends and family of that person, and you go back, and all too often that is usually the first chance people get to actually see a picture of their immediate relatives.
What I'm hearing is it's a wonderful blend of microchips and shoe leather.
Yes.
And I think about it that the DNA, the cutting edge DNA research is your microchips, along with these massive databases through Ancestry.com and other entities. And then you have the shoe leather of having to go through the census records and go through property records.
All of that.
And that to me makes it very, very interesting, because it's more than just a two-dimensional puzzle. You know, this is like a multidimensional puzzle where one thing on one level could have a direct impact on something on a different level. And I can tell you from my experience as a private investigator, much of what you're dealing with these days is cutting edge. I mean, think about the DNA testing and how good it's gotten, the databases, how they're getting populated, and the explosion of social media.
Yeah.
10, 15 years ago,
nothing. It's the perfect storm. It has literally revolutionized adoption reform efforts in this country. Mm-hmm. And it's wonderful because there were over 3 million people that were adopted in what is called the Big Baby Grab, which was from the 1940s to the 1970s. And those 3 million now are getting up in age and so forth and have children of their own and so on. And so that is the target base for people that come to me for assistance. They are part of that 3 million.
So, John, how can listeners reach you if they want to learn more?
Oh, well, I'm easily available. Most of my work is done through, you know, social media. I have a website, www.family-orchard.com, and I'm sure you can post it on your page. And my email is there as well. And I personally chose Family Orchard for a company name because most people in genealogy work on family trees. And for people of unknown parentage, of, you know, our donor children, our adopted children, they have an orchard that you have to dig through to find out their story of origin.
That's great. And it is true. In the show notes, I will have your website and other ways to contact you. I'll also do a Wikipedia, I hope, on Georgia Tan.
Please do.
And there's a couple books that you thought might be of value. We mentioned it during our warm-up. What books do you think that our listeners might be interested in?
Well, specifically on Georgia Tan, the defining book is called Baby Thief, and I'll give you the links to that. And it just opens it all up. And, you know, again, always what the Jesuits trained me in is you look at any situation and you try to figure out why is it this way rather than another way. And if you have that kind of an imagination, of that kind of a critical process, you'll do very well in this business.
Well, John, I think you combine both deductive reasoning and inductive reasoning very well.
Thank you.
And thank you. And I'm really happy that you're a guest on our show, and I'm sure our listeners will say the same. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I hope that I've earned your interest and your time. Please leave any comments on the website, www.johnhoda.com. That's www.johnhoda.com. Our next podcast guest is Catherine Ramsland. Dr. Ramsland holds graduate degrees in forensic psychology, clinical psychology, and philosophy. She teaches forensic psychology at DeSales University in Pennsylvania. She has written on the subject of serial killers, crime scene investigations, forensic science, mass murder, and sex offenders. This is an episode not to be missed. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to hear other great detective stories, please go to the website and click on our podcast page. There you'll find the backlist. Now, you're probably asking, John, what about your own stories? Do you have any? Sure enough, I do. And they are available to you free as a download right to your inbox. I have 8 short stories and 8 vignettes in a book titled Mugshots, My Favorite Detective Stories. Now, here's my ask. You were either informed, inspired, or entertained by stories today. Don't be bashful. Share this link with your friend. Better still, go to the iTunes website and leave a review. It's the best way to grow the circle around our campfire. If you have any questions, please contact me through the website, www.johnhoda.com, J-O-H-N-H-O-D-A.com. Thanks so much, and have a great day.